board is providing.
You may now proceed.
Yes, thank you. So the board is preparing comments on both the cross-community working group on the naming transition as well as this cross-community working group on accountability. So this is fairly early days for us. So you know, the board's yet to form a formal position on the proposal, but in having this call, I think would really help board members get up to speed on the key elements of the proposal and help give us context to you know, eventually provide a formal response. What I suggest is that the, I guess the co-chairs of the cross-community working group perhaps go through some of the high-level points and then we'll open it up for questions from board members, which will mostly be questions of clarity because, as I noted, we don't actually have a formal position yet, but we're still learning. So I'm not sure whether Matthew or Thomas or Leon would like to kick off on the to discuss the proposal.
I take on Bruce. This is Matthew speaking. Can everyone hear me?
Matthew? Yes, we can.
Okay. So I'm Matthew. I'm one of the three co-chairs of the Cross Community Working Group Accountability. And first of all, thank you very much to Steve and Bruce and your board members for organizing this session. As Steve said, this is really intended to introduce the proposals as well as answer any clarifying questions. And the three co-chairs, we've split the presentation between ourselves to take you through the various aspects of the recommendations so far. And we'll take questions on each block of slides to make it a little bit more interactive. Before jumping into the presentation itself, a quick reminder that our group's the public comment is about an initial draft proposal, so it's not consensus recommendations yet. There's still a lot of aspects where we're looking for guidance from the community, and as well as aspects where we want to ensure we're moving in the right direction in the community views. So that's the kind of input we are looking for in the public comment period as a whole. And the public comment period ends on June the 3rd. In terms of resources available, of course, there's a beautiful public comment document, but there's also graphics that you'll see in the slides that are designed to help facilitate understanding, but obviously the report itself has a higher value, so we encourage everyone to go and look in the report as much as possible. The slides, as Thomas is stating in the chat, the slides we're using are the same we've been using in the webinars that we held early this week. And I'm going to jump to the next slide, but first of all, I want to stress that Bruce Tomkin has been our board liaison in this work, and he's played an outstanding role in facilitating discussions and providing information about how the board's working, and that's been immensely useful. So I want to acknowledge his contribution to this group. So the next slide, the slide you have now on the chat in the AC room shows that there are two tracks. Obviously, you know that very well. And the CCWG proposals, when finalized, will come to you for in order to be transferred to the NTIA along with the ICT proposals. The one item I'd like to stress here is this linkage that it exists between the CWG stewardship proposals and the CCWG accountability proposals. And as a, this is extremely important. And so I want to welcome on this call, we have Lisa Furr, one of the co-chairs of the CWG stewardship attending in case there's any question regarding the linkage between the two groups or the... So she's on standby if there's any questions on this interdependence of both groups. And I want to really emphasize how we've been coordinating on a very regular basis with the CWG stewardship, and it's been very productive all across the period of time where we've been most active. One last aspect, I know it's a very delicate position for the board because, in a way, of course, the board is one of the key stakeholders in the community, and you're all very much involved and skilled, and you know, some of you know Ankan inside out. But also you're in charge of facilitating the process and leading this process forward. And as we all know, this may lead to some positions being misread, or whether in good faith or in bad faith, it doesn't matter. I think it's extremely important that there's regular exchanges such as this one so that questions can be asked directly, and we leave as little room as possible for misinterpretations of everyone's positions. So there's going to be a big opportunity in the next few weeks to set the right tone of the various comments, and we hope the questions we have now can lead to further dialogue until you formalize the position. If you go to the next slide, it's a quick view of where we are now. So the proposals are essentially work stream one. So those mechanisms that would enhance ICANN's accountability that must be in place or committed to within the time frame of the transition. I mean, you know that, I think, very well, so I won't take too much time on this. And the next slide is the timeline so far. These timelines, you may remember, we started our work in December. We started with assessing the current situation. In Frankfurt in January, our group came up with some high-level requirements for work stream one around the empowerment of community and the review and process and so on. And this was discussed, including with the board, in Singapore, and then refined in the face-to-face meeting that took place in March in Istanbul, and very intense remote work schedule in April to get to this public comment in May. And I want to also stress that we've had opportunity to have independent legal support. It's a great asset to our group, so we want to acknowledge ICANN's willingness to provide this is absolutely key to the success of this transition. And we're very aware of what this means in terms of allocation of resources from the board to the transition process. So I think it was worth mentioning that this is an important aspect. I don't know if on the overall process there are any questions at this point. Okay, so let's move into the substance of proposals, and I will hand over to Thomas Rickert for the overall architecture of accountability mechanism. Thomas?
Thank you very much, Mathieu, and hello everybody. This is Thomas Rickert, and I'm the GNSO appointed co-chair to the CCWG accountability. I will take you through a couple of slides speaking to the overall architecture of the enhanced accountability system that we're working on, and then also go through the various powers that an empowered community would have should we reach consensus on the overall package. It's worth noting that it wasn't just the co-chairs doing this, but we had an excellent working group with an outstanding commitment and high quality of work, and also the rapporteurs that we had and have chairing the sub-teams have been very efficient. When we did the webinars for the community, we asked the rapporteurs to present their respective parts of work or areas of work. For this call, we've chosen a slightly different approach i.e. you will hear the co-chairs leading you through the slides, but the rapporteurs are also on the call and will likely take a more active role when it comes to answering your questions. And now, Mathieu mentioned that we established the status quo at the in the first phase of our work, i.e. we looked at what accountability mechanisms there are already, and ICANN, so we created an inventory of existing accountability mechanisms. We also analyzed what the community had previously been saying and requesting with respect to accountability, and we used the report stemming from the public comment period held by ICANN last year as a basis for that, and then we came up with recommendations in terms of requirements that we would have without talking about how these would be implemented legally. And we will speak to that later during this presentation. But you will remember that in Singapore, we presented four building blocks out of which we thought we could build all the accountability mechanisms that are needed. And these could, you know, we've been looking for precedent in other areas of life, and we found that some governments or some states are quite efficient in sharing powers, exercising checks and balances, and so on and so forth, and we're sort of replicating this in ICANN. So you would have an empowered community that would be the legislative or the people. You would have the ICANN board, which would be the executive. And I should note that whenever we speak about the ICANN board, we're not looking at any individual sitting on the board now. So all these worst-case scenarios that we have to play through are only for some future rogue board members or a rogue board as such, but do not relate to any experiences that we had with the current board. Then the third building block would be the ICANN bylaws, which would form sort of the constitution of this mini-state called ICANN, and then we would have a judiciary, which would be the independent review mechanism. Can we go to the next slide, please? So we said that we need certain powers for the community to have, but that begs the question of, you know, we can do whatever we like at this stage, but who makes sure that the board itself doesn't turn these over by just changing the bylaws subsequently and, let's say, remove the judiciary, i.e. the independent review process, or applying other changes that would jeopardize the functionality of the accountability architecture. And that is why we came up with the idea of fundamental bylaws, i.e. bylaws that can only be changed with a very high voting threshold and only be changed if the community expressly consent to such changes. You know, we did not want to cast our proposals on mission or core values of ICANN in stone, because ICANN is working in an evolving and potentially changing environment. So we can't perpetuate what ICANN is doing now, yet in order for ICANN to be allowed to do different things than it is doing now, or to apply other mechanisms than we're currently envisaging, you would need a very high voting threshold. And we thought that that those bylaws that need to be fundamental would be the amended mission commitments and core values, the independent review process, the power to veto non-fundamental bylaw changes and to approve changes to fundamental bylaws, any reviews required by the CWG stewardship, and new community powers such as the recall of the board. And to these community powers, I'm going to speak in a moment. You will see here the first link to the CWG. So the CWG felt that the IANA functions review was an important feature of the revised IANA system. And therefore, we wanted to make sure that only we do have these reviews, but also that these reviews can't easily be sunset at any future point in time. Next slide, please. Okay, let's talk about the empowered community then briefly. You will have heard us reporting that we have five powers that the community needs, and that would be the possibility to reconsider or reject budget or strategy and operating plan, the possibility to reconsider and reject changes to ICANN's standard bylaws, the possibility to approve changes to fundamental bylaws that I just spoke to, the possibility to remove individual directors, as well as recalling the entire ICANN board. And we thought that if we enact and make enforceable the execution of these powers, then we would basically have everything the community needs at its fingertip to shape ICANN in future. So even in the post-transition phase, if we manage to incorporate these community powers into ICANN's bylaws and enact them, then we can leave a lot of what has to be done in terms of details, but also in terms of workstream two accountability mechanisms for a later stage. So this was, as we felt, the least invasive way to change ICANN's accountability, because we're using building blocks that are only that are already in place. We're only amending them so that they would provide more accountability. And what's important to say also is that at the moment, as you would certainly know, the U.S. government has the possibility to request a certain behavior from ICANN. And what do we do in the absence of this historical relationship? We take the power that the U.S. government had and provide the community with the power, and therefore the notion of the empowered community is one of the major themes in our accountability work. I haven't yet spoken about the legal mechanism, the legal vehicle, for putting these community powers to work. We will speak to those a little bit later. Next slide, please. But we've been working on escalation paths for all the individual community powers of the empowered community. And I will just walk you through this very briefly. I know that you might have questions, but we leave them for later for the Q&A, because some of that you will surely have heard of. Now, the ICANN board and staff will provide an ICANN budget in a draft format that will then go through public comment and ultimately to the ICANN board, which approves the budget. And then there's the policy, the possibility, if an SO or an AC objects to the approved budget, then it can bring the objection to the empowered community, which will then take a vote, and we're currently thinking of a 66% voting threshold in combination with the respective members. So if you look at this circle that represents the SOs and ACs, and we're currently proposing a mechanism whereby all the SOs and ACs, except for RSEC and RSEC, do get 5 votes, and ESSEC and RSEC do get 2 votes. And if 66% of the votes are in favor of sort of challenging the budget, then the motion would be carried and the board needs to rework the budget. And in order to prevent this from being a ping-pong thing whereby the community brings up new items each and every time, we have installed or proposed a higher voting threshold for the second time round for 75%. And also, all the issues that the ICANN community has with the budget, strategic, or operating plan needs to be brought up, and it can't be brought up during the second time of intervention. And by that, we want to make sure that we don't have an iterative objection process, if you wish. Next slide, please. Now you see a recurring pattern here. For the ICANN bylaws change, again, the proposal is made by the ICANN board after having gone through a public comment period, then amended bylaws are approved. An SO or AC can object and thereby invoke the empowered community to deliberate the case. And if there is a 66% versus 75% voting threshold, then the ICANN board needs to redo the change that it has previously been made. So that's a reconsideration. So the community will not suggest any concrete wordings of the bylaws, nor do they have the power to actually request that, but they basically tell the board to go back and work on it a little bit more in order to take on board the community wishes. Next slide, please. Then we have to change to fundamental bylaws, and that would be the other way around. So we don't have a veto mechanism here, but we would have an explicit approval process. And for that approval, since the bylaws are fundamental, some of them called golden bylaws, you know, which clearly shows that these are very important subjects that are being dealt with, and therefore 75% of the votes need to be cast in favor of such bylaw change. Next slide. Then we come to the removal of directors, and for the removal of individual directors, we have two different approaches. The first would be for those directors that are being sent to the board by SOs and AC, and they can then revoke their respective members. So that is a process that lies pretty much in the hands of the SOs and ACs. And it's important to note that only the SO or AC that has sent somebody to the board can remove that individual. So it's not possible for, let's say, the ASO to remove somebody from the CCMSO. Next slide, please. For non-com appointed directors, things are slightly different, and therefore we suggest that in our reference model that at least two SO or ACs need to request that an individual board member is removed. Then the non-com would consider this petition, and we have not yet made up our mind whether the current non-com or a special removal non-com would be called upon to vote in favor of the dismissal of a board member, but we're suggesting that whichever body takes care of that 75% of the votes are needed in order to remove a board member. Next slide, please. When it comes to requests for recalling the entire ICANN board, we're asking for a high entry threshold in order to prevent abuse of this mechanism, and therefore three SOs and ACs need to file this petition, and we need to have at least one AC plus two SOs or the other way around, so that it's not possible for three SOs in isolation to file that request. We would then have deliberation on the request. The individual groups would then debate the case, i.e. the GNSO or the CCNSO or the other groups would deliberate, and they would then either through consensus or by casting a vote, where we suggest a voting threshold of 75% decide on the removal of the or recalling of the entire board. So I think I should leave it here. Let's move to the next slide, which I think is the slide on the membership model that Leon Sanchez is going to present to you in a moment, but I would like to pause for a moment and ask whether there are any questions from your side. I don't see any. There's one hand raised in the lobby. That's Kavus Arase. Kavus, please.
Yeah, good day to all of you. I think this meeting is more or less for ICANN to raise the question, but nevertheless, during these periods, we had come to a question that for recalling the whole board member, who participate in the voting? Because those who does not designate individual and would not participate in the removal of individual board, as you have mentioned, have the right to participate in the removal or recalling of the whole board member. This is silent in your slide. You put a circle, you put everybody, but who has the right to vote here you have not mentioned. In previous case, for recalling the individual board, you clearly mentioned only one AC, and that is at large, but not other ACs. But here, who has the right to participate in the voting of the recall of the entire board member? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kavus. And for those that are considering to put themselves into the queue, let's please have the board members ask their questions first, because this is a meeting to update those. Since this is a legal question, I think that Leon Sanchez is probably best placed to answer that. Leon, would you volunteer to respond to that?
Of course, Thomas. Thank you very much. So, about to describe with the membership model, there needs to be a legal vehicle for the community, the different SOs and ACs, to enforce the different rights and exercise the different powers that we are trying to provide the community with this proposal. And answering Kavu's question, anyone that appoints a director and that, of course, forms any kind of legal vehicle, it doesn't have to be a non-incorporated association. I am going to give details on this a little bit later. But any SO or AC that conforms any kind of legal entity to be the legal vehicle that would enable them to enforce the rights or exercise the powers would be able to vote on the process of removing directors and, of course, exercising the rest of the powers that my coaches have described during this presentation. So if any SO or AC should decide not to form any kind of legal vehicle to become a member or a designer under the current proposed structures, then those who decided not to conform with this would, of course, wouldn't be able to enforce the rights or exercise the powers. I hope this answers your question, Kabus. And I'll turn back to you, Thomas.
Thank you very much, Leon. You have not answered the question. The question is that in case of removal of the individual director, only SOs and one AC could participate because only one AC designates the board. In case of recalling, you said that those who are members, all other ACs who are not designating director, if they are members, they could participate in the removal of the whole board member. In that case, why they could not participate in the removal of individual board members? So it's contradiction between what you said and what is in the slide before for the recalling, not recalling, removing individual board member. Please bring back the slide removal of individual board member. There's only one AC could attend in the voting, but not the others. But why in the case of recall of the whole board members, all ACs and SOs, if they are party of the member of unincorporated association, they could participate. There is some legal gap between these two. Please clarify.
Carlos, thank you very much. I would kindly request you to keep this conversation on the list and, of course, within the scope of our calls. Our regular scheduled calls, since this call is meant for addressing questions by board members. So I would kindly ask for your comprehension here, and I would now turn back to Thomas.
Thank you very much, Leon. Let me add that the proposals, and actually we have offered various options for various items that you find in our report, are based on the assumption that the individual SOs and ACs would actually form unincorporated associations. That's what Leon is going to talk about in a moment, and thereby have the full range of powers at their fingertips to participate in this model. So we felt that it was not for us to decide who would join or who would not, but we are giving equal treatment to all SOs and ACs, because the legal model that we have suggested as a reference model would have the best means of enforceability. But that doesn't mean that other ways of participation are impossible, but those were, that's my understanding, not necessarily be enforceable rights according to statute, but we would need to have contractual provisions to allow for enforcement or, having certain powers. I think I should leave it here and ask the two people in the queue for their questions, and that would be Steve Crocker first and then Shirin Chalabi.
Thank you very much. I'll say the obligatory but nonetheless extremely strongly felt position of the board that we are absolutely quite impressed and grateful for the huge amount of work that everybody has put in on this. And despite what people's worst fears might be, we're strongly in favor of accountability and transparency, and we view ourselves as being on the same side as you rather than in opposition. So with that out of the way, let me get into a very specific point that has troubled some of us. With respect to the recall of individual board members, it would seem that the underlying notion is that the individual board members are representing the constituencies that put them there, and that the implicit reason for being for triggering a recall of an individual board member might be that they are not carrying out the wishes of that particular constituency. That's very standard operation for a representative type of government. But in our case, we've made a very strong point in our bylaws, in our training of board members, and in our discipline that board members serve the entire organization, the entire community, not their individual appointing bodies, that the board is not operating as a brokering of individual constituencies' concerns, but is acting in the best interest. And as I say, that's documented in a very important part of our the way we view ourselves, the way we train ourselves, the way we talk about ourselves. And it would seem to me that the creation of a recall of individual board members cuts directly against that and pushes strongly in the direction of turning the board into more of a representative government, sort of representative legislature, as opposed to a more cohesive oversight process, which is where we are now. Would you like to comment on that?
I guess we do understand the composition and the background of the composition of the board. The possibility to remove individual directors, as we're suggesting it now, was felt like a measure of less weight to remove those board members that have done something entirely wrong or not in the best interest of the community. We are cognizant of the fact that recalling the whole board is a very big stick that we shouldn't apply lightly, and therefore the individual director's removal would be potentially an adequate and balanced way to approach issues in the organization. I would like to invite rapporteurs and co-chairs to chime in if they would like to add to this answer, but I guess that's the best answer that I can give at the moment.
Before you do, thank you very much, and I do want to listen to the others, but let me add just a point or two, because I think you've said something very important there. I do recall when this was added to the proposal that it represented, as you say, a way of having a smaller stick than removing the entire board all at once. And there is a broad principle of what's called proportionality, which I think this fits into very nicely, that you want to be able to respond with something that is meaningful for whatever the problem is, as opposed to having only one gigantic option, which you then don't want to exercise very often, which is fine. I will point out that the board already has, or I should say the community and ICANN have, mechanisms for removing board members who are behaving inappropriately today. For example, if a board member is not handling confidential information properly, is and seems to be serving private needs as opposed to the public needs, that's a violation of our rules, and there are mechanisms for removing a board member already. And then, of course, the community has, the board members have 3-year terms, and each and every board member has to make a case for being returned or if he wishes to come back. So those mechanisms exist, and I don't want to go into it too much, but they actually do work in various ways. So it's, but it's nonetheless, I think, at least requires some clarification as to what criteria would be reasonable or appropriate to use for removing an individual board member. Another element of this is what information is available about an individual board member as opposed to the board's actions as a whole. We generally reach consensus and have only on occasion individual objections. We take those very seriously and we make those on available at any time to any board member. But it is not common for us to wind up with factions or the equivalent of parties pushing in one direction or another at the board level.
Thanks, Steve. Let me add 2 points to my previous answer. Number one, we have currently suggested that the processes leading to the removal of an individual board member shall be defined by the different SOs and ACs. So we have not yet defined anything that would prescribe how the various groups would deal with such cases. We take good note of your reminder that some of those mechanisms are already in place, and I think that we will take your point into consideration that we will likely have to give some guidance to the SOs and ACs setting out some basic standards for such processes. But I think I should leave it there and move to Shireen.
Thank you, Thomas. I'd like to say I support Steve's comments, but I'd like to add one more concern and for clarification. And again, it's to do with the removal of board members, individual board members. It seems from what you're showing here that there are two classes of board members. Those that are accountable to the whole community and those that are accountable only to the SO or AC that has elected them. And that is a contradiction to the standard principle of governance that every board member is accountable to all stakeholders and must act at all times in the interest of all stakeholders. So could you please clarify why a board member that would be elected by an SO and AC can only be removed, or the process initiated by this SO or AC, whereas a non-com can be the process can be initiated by any SO and AC, and not necessarily the non-com. I think there should be one process for all board members, and not create two classes of board members. Thank you.
Thanks, Shireen. The very short answer is that there are legal implications for different treatment. I suggest that we get back to you in writing, and we will have a Q&A which is publicly available, so the answer doesn't only go to you but to the interested community, and we will provide more legal feedback on that. The idea was certainly that we are considering cases where board members fail to act in the best interest of the whole community, but there are certainly cases in which individual board members fail to act as they are requested by their respective groups. And that's a mechanism that's already in place now, where the designators, let's say, the organizations that are seating people on the board can recall them. So we are basically stating the status quo. But I would suggest we will get back to you in more detail. Your point that there should be a unique standard of review for all these cases is well noted. Renalia.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you all right.
Ah, I pose a question focusing on the formation of the unincorporated association. The question pertains to if structures were to move forward and form unincorporated association, would the process involve reviewing the structure's accountability mechanism, affirming it, or even strengthening it?
This is an excellent opportunity for me, Renalia, to hand it over to Leon Sanchez to introduce the concept of unincorporated associations in the first place. And we will, you know, after he has made some general remarks on that, I'm sure that he will gladly respond to your question. I hope that this is okay. Leon, over to you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. So with regards to the membership model that we are proposing as a preferred option, it doesn't mean that this is the only way to do things, but only that the legal advice that we have received from the external lawyers points that this is the most effective and easiest way to provide the community with the powers and achieve the goals that we're trying to reach here. So, as I said earlier, there needs to be a legal vehicle for the community to be able to enforce the different rights and the powers that we're trying to provide the community with in our proposal. So, the two easiest ways to do this would be having either a membership or a designated model. And the designated model has the downside that not all powers that we're trying to provide the community with could be enforced if we should go with the designated model, and that is why the membership model is being tagged as the preferred model in this proposal. And for this, as I said, there would be the need to have a legal vehicle, and the proposed legal vehicle would be to form unincorporated associations by those SOs and ACs that would like to, of course, have enough power or a physical vehicle to exercise the different powers. And how would this work in the membership model? Well, of course, there would be a petition by any SO or AC, and there would be a check to see if the petition meets the required threshold, and if it does, well, then it would go for voting by the community mechanism, and this, of course, would be along in coordination with the different members, and if the voting threshold is met, then it would follow through on communities' decision. Now, speaking of unincorporated associations, if we can jump into the next slide, please. Speaking of unincorporated associations, an unincorporated association is only a legal vehicle or the legal entity that will provide this personhood for the different members to exercise the membership powers. There have been questions on whether there are any requirements or any special needs to form these unincorporated associations. The legal advice that we have received is that it is very easy, and this would be very lightweight structures that don't require very complex arrangements. And as any legal body, their governing documents or their governing structures would be set by each of the SOs and ACs. So we, of course, privilege the current bottom-up and multi-stakeholder approach that we have within ICANN, and this would be, in turn, filed upon the State Department of California. So they are notified that we are forming these unincorporated associations. And with that, then each SONAC that chooses to go through this model would be empowered to enforce the rights and, of course, exercise powers. Now, as I said earlier, speaking of unincorporated associations, it's only the easiest and the fastest way to provide the legal vehicle for the community to exercise the powers. But this doesn't mean that it is the only way. As I said earlier, there needs to be a legal vehicle for this, but it could also be any type of, let's say, for example, a nonprofit from any other region, any other country, could also be a legal vehicle for exercising these powers. The only thing is that the unincorporated association is the simplest way to achieve this. And as I said, also, should any SO or AC choose to not go and conform any kind of legal vehicle, not only an unincorporated association, but any kind of legal vehicle, then they would, of course, be lacking the power to enforce their rights and exercise the powers that this proposal is trying to provide them with. So if we could jump to the next slide, please. And I don't know, it may be a good time to make a small pause. Rinaldi, I see your hand is still up. Do you want to comment on the issue of unincorporated associations? No? Okay, that was
no, it's answer. Okay. Please proceed.
Yes, thanks. So jumping into the next slide, please. Thank you. So this proposal also recommends that we enhance the independent review process that we currently have. And in this new IRP, the decisions would be binding. It allows also for review of both the substantive and procedural compliance, which is one thing that has been stressed by the community that this new IRP should provide. And it is thought to be more accessible in terms of who has standing to initiate this IRP. It would entail, of course, a lower cost for those who want to exercise an action through the IRP. And we are thinking, or the community is thinking, of a new standing panel of 7 people that would conform the members of this IRP panel that would, of course, be called for making decisions. Can we jump into the next slide, please? So the core of this recommendation is a standing 7 member panel to serve as a fully independent judicial body that would function for the acting committee, of course. And we have thought of many characteristics for this IRP panel. We are thinking, of course, of having a culturally and geographically diverse panel, a term-limited panel, and independent of ICANN, including their SOs and ACs, a fixed term. These members would be compensated by ICANN, and there has been also some questions on how we think that it would be possible to achieve independence of the panelists when we have them being compensated by ICANN. And this is something that is still in the process of getting to be addressed. And this is why we are also trying to have the input from the community in this public comment. And this panel would also be, of course, formed by significant experts in international arbitration and with, of course, wide knowledge or deep knowledge on how ICANN works and the different issues that affect ICANN's activities. The panel member selection process would be through a mechanism that would enable third-party international arbitral bodies to nominate candidates, and these candidates would be put in front of or on the table for the board for consideration, and the board would select this possible panelists and propose confirmation, and then the community mechanism would confirm this appointment. So can we jump into the next slide, please? So how would actually filing an IRP would work under this proposal and under this new structure? Anyone who is materially affected by an ICANN action or inaction, and by ICANN we mean, of course, both the board and staff, could initiate this independent review process. And this would, of course, be subject to having this material affection or this harm done with regards to the articles of incorporation or the bylaws including the commitments that we're trying to incorporate into the new into the new proposed bylaws. So there would be the flowchart that you see here starts with a board action or inaction, of course, that would then would materially harm anyone within the ICANN community. And then the first approach would be, of course, try to scale things without coming into the action of an IRP panel. Then this would mean that there would be a good faith effort to resolve any controversy. And if this does not reach any kind of arrangement, then the IRP panel would be triggered, and there would be a filing for consideration of the IRP panel. The IRP process would be followed. Of course, we are in we're still pending of defining how this process would work, and then the IRP panel would reach a decision, and this decision would, of course, be binding. Can we jump into the next slide, please? So how would IRP decisions work when they are reached, or how these IRP decisions would be delivered to the community? We have these standing IRP panel made out of 7 members, and we thought of a formula that could provide the community with the resolution of the different controversies, either by designating a one-person panel from one of the 7 members of the standing panel, or a 3-person panel, and ICANN and the complaining party would agree, of course, on the panelists or the 3 panelists, and this panel would reach the decisions, would decide on the matters. As we said, we're trying to enhance the IRP that we have now into a new IRP that would also look into not only process but substance. And these decisions would need to have different characteristics that would, of course, that you can see here in this graphic. They would be binding on ICANN and not subject to appeal, except on very limited basis. The document should, of course, need to be well-reasoned-based and in line with the applicable standards. This decision should come in a timely fashion. It shouldn't be. It shouldn't take long for the panel to reach the decision. And the members should strongly consider existing precedent in decision making to help enable consistency in treatment over time. So we are thinking of building, of course, a precedent-based system that would help the panelists resolve any controversies that would be brought in front of the IRP. So the possible decisions are that an action or inaction was in violation of ICANN's articles of the corporation and or bylaws, including commitments spelled out in the proposed statements of mission, commitments and core values, and then, of course, it would provide with a solution to the controversy. So if we can jump to the next slide, please. So the request for reconsideration process reform deals with a key of number of reforms that have been requested by the community, and whereby ICANN boards of directors are obliged to reconsider a recent decision, action, or inaction by ICANN's board or staff. These are relevant because, as we said, we expand the scope of people that can have standing to begin this process. The goals would broaden so we can provide more transparency in the dismissal process and provide board with reasonable right to dismiss frivolous requests. This is important, of course, because we don't want to paralyze ICANN with frivolous requests. And we would like the composition to have more board member engagement and less legal department. And the decision-making would be, of course, improved in transparency and would have a rebuttal opportunity. And the accessibility would extend the time for request of reconsideration from 15 to 13 days. So with this, I would like to open the floor for questions again. Okay, I see no one raising their hand, so I would. I see Kuo. We can't listen to you, Kuo. You might be on mute. Okay, so I'm sorry, but we are not able to listen to Kuo.
Well, I just have, this is Bruce Tonkin. I just have a question, I suppose, in terms of workload that might be coming before an IRP panel. So my understanding is the scope of the IRP has been broadened from just the following the bylaws, but also incorporates compliance with core values and a broader set of topics. The step two of the process there says anyone materially harmed. Is there some sort of test that would be done there at step two? Because otherwise I could see a lot of stuff will end up in step four, which is before the IRP panel, because people could put, you know, could claim to be materially harmed on a whole raft of topics, I guess. Just wondering if there's any thought to just how you have some sort of threshold or test before you move too far into the process.
Thanks, Bruce. I would like to turn to Becky Bear for details on this question that you raised. Becky, would you like to provide us with details on this?
Sure. Bruce, I think that the standard, you know, materially harmed is actually the standard that exists today. So that is not a change. And the panel, you know, I think once a panel is invoked, has the ability to say, you know, in a fast track, there's been no material harm, that pleading cycle would be permitted to go on. But that is actually not a change.
Okay, so the test, the judgment of the material harm then is done by the panel, Becky, in other words. So everything goes through to step four, essentially, and then at step four, the panel can decide whether it proceeds on the basis of whether they believe it's a material harm. Is that correct?
Yes, that's the current arrangement. I mean, I think there is a requirement for constructive engagement and the ability to invoke a mediator beforehand that is being contemplated. But that the question is, you know, how you would sort of make a decision on whether somebody claiming to be harmed has or has not been materially harmed. That's a question of fact that the panel would need to get to.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much, Becky. Thank you very much, Bruce. I would now turn to Jerry Sadowski, who's going to come. Jerry, could you please take the floor?
Thanks very much. It's probable that I don't understand exactly what you're thinking of here, but let me raise this anyway. What you're doing is saying that the IRP process only applies to a board action which results in somebody being materially harmed. Now, it's certainly possible that an organization within ICANN, an SO within ICANN, could do something which where somebody feels that they're materially harmed. But is the assumption that SO, whatever it does, is approved by the board, and therefore it's the board that is responsible for the material harm, no matter how it comes to the board? Or is it possible that the IRP panel also adjudicates things that come from other parts of ICANN?
Thanks, George. Yes.
George, the language in the proposal is an action or inaction by an ICANN decision maker. It could be, board staff. Theoretically, it could be an SO or AC, but the action would have had to have a material effect on the person who is making the complaint, and so that probably requires some action, either or inaction by the staff or the board. So theoretically, yes, but since the SOs and ACs themselves don't have the power unilaterally to harm, to cause material harm, I think, that ultimately it will involve action or inaction of the board or staff.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I see no other hands raised for questions. So now I would like to turn to my co-chair, Matthew Bain. So, Matthew, could you please?
Thank you very much, Liam. This is Matthew Bay speaking. I noticed on the chat Asha's question regarding the panelist selection process. And maybe while we are on the IRP, we should close with this particular item. It's on slide number 16. Thank you. And it's on the right of the slide. You'll see the process that's currently contemplated is that third-party arbitration bodies nominate candidates. They are selected or at least shortlisted by the ICANN board, which proposes to the community body the candidates, which are then confirmed by this community. So we could obviously consider auditions or something. So that's the current selection process that's being considered, Asha, and I hope that answers your question, which you raised in the chat. And obviously, that's one of the aspects where we're looking for input. Moving to the other sections, so we have a little bit of time for open question and answers at the end. I have a very limited number of slides remaining, rest assured. So if we move to the slide, probably 20, I guess. Yes. Slide 20 is about the affirmation of commitment for use. So the assumption from our group is that the affirmation of commitment could disappear in the future. That's not something we recommend in any way. It's not within our scope. But because it could disappear, the idea is to bring the review system into the ICANN bylaws so that, for instance, the accountability and transparency reviews keep being considered and run on a regular basis. A few of the items we propose is the ability to sunset reviews or create new reviews. We suggest a change on the way the appointments to the review teams are made and enhance transparency and access to internal documents for these review teams, and a slightly stronger requirement for the board to consider approval and begin implementation of review team outputs. That was part of a larger stress test exercise which we conducted, and that's going to be the next slide. As you know, there was a very high requirement from our group to stress test the proposals. And as a consequence, we have been defining contingencies very early on, and we have 26 risks that we consolidated into five categories ranging from financial crisis to failure of accountability. And we've run each stress test against the current accountability framework for ICANN, as well as the proposed accountability framework out of our proposals. And obviously, the proposed section is still subject to the finalization of the proposals, but it's a very useful tool to look at what would be improved, what would work differently. And so it's a key aspect of our work, and I think the board itself, through your knowledge of the key risks for the corporation, but also your experience, you're well placed to provide contributions if you see contingencies that need to be addressed and haven't been so far, obviously. I will not spend too much time on this because I want to move to questions in the end. So if we go to the next slide, it's about the linkage with the CWG stewardship. So the CWG stewardship expectations from our group were outlined in their report as well as in various correspondence. And it's basically that there is the ability for the community to have greater transparency around IANA costs, and greater the power to reject a budget was called for explicitly. Secondly, that the ICANN board decisions, especially when after a review such as the IANA performance review that's being considered by the CWG, should be reinforced, and that's one thing, another thing we address. The IANA review function we've mentioned already, and it's part of our proposals. And there was also the expectation that the independent panels and the review processes should not interfere with delegation, redelegation issues for CCTLDs at this point, until the appropriate process is conducted to define the policy in this regard. So that's sort of our checklist with the CWG, and it is our assessment that we are very consistent and in line with the CWG on this. And so finally, that in terms of timeline, on the next slide, so our public comment ends on June the 3rd. We expect to be in a position in Buenos Aires to share the conclusions of this public comment and further investigate the proposals where needed. A second public comment is planned for July and span across the summer, and it is expected that we would finalize the Workstream 1 proposals, obviously if all goes well, in time for approval in Dublin. And you will see on this timeline that we've also started considering how much time it would take to implement the various proposals. in order to check that it's consistent with the overall transition timeline and the political window of opportunity. And I think that's of special importance considering the recent communication by Larry Stripling asking for community clarifications about the expected timelines. I think I'll leave it at that for that section in order to not to bore you too much with details. But obviously this is to now open to any broad question on the approach and the concepts that we're introducing, or any other question that you may have at this point. And Bruce, maybe I can hand it over to you to chair that part of the question and answer.
Yes, certainly. Thank you for taking us through the proposal, and I certainly encourage all the board members and all members of the community to read the actual report itself, because there's a lot of detail behind the set of slides that we've seen. But again, I'll open it up for any other questions from members of the board. And perhaps if I haven't got any questions from the board, open it up to, I guess, the co-chairs, if you've got any questions for us at this stage. One thing that actually might be helpful would be, given we have the Buenos Aires meeting coming up, what the CCWG has plans both for consultation with the community and what opportunities there would be for board members to engage with the CCWG during the Buenos Aires meeting.
So this is Mathieu speaking, and I can try and address this. So we have a face-to-face meeting in Buenos Aires the Friday before the ICANN meeting, so on June the 19th. And as usual, this is a meeting which is open to any member and participant, so board members will be welcome to attend if they're here and available. We are currently planning a specific session on the Sunday, so on June the 21st, I think it's being set now, so which will be a CCWG board session, just like we did in Singapore. Once again, an open session, obviously. And we will engage each ASO and AC to obviously propose specific sessions of discussions regarding the proposals and the way they are moving forward after the public comment. So that would also enable board members to participate to the discussions. And because, Bruce, you opened up for questions we might have to the board, I think I seized this opportunity to maybe ask whether the board currently has plans to respond to our public comment. And if there's any outstanding question or need for support to enable that is currently foreseen. And I think that would be my question.
Yeah, so I think the quick answer is yes, we do intend to respond. We're kind of working on, like other members of the community, we're kind of working on these, I suppose, in order of the deadline. So I think the cross-community working group on naming has a deadline that is earlier than your deadline. So we're working on our draft for that first, and then we'll be working on a response to the CCWG on accountability. So what I expect you'll see us respond to the naming transition proposal, some days before you see a response to the cross-community working group on accountability, but I do expect that you'll get a response from us. Okay. I guess if there's no further questions, then I might close the call and perhaps hand over to Steve just for any concluding remarks. But again, really, we really appreciate you taking the time, and also the many members of the Cross Community Working Group that have listened into this call as well. We appreciate the time everyone's putting into this. So I'll hand back to Steve just for closing remarks. We've got Steve. Perhaps we haven't got Steve. All right. Well, this is Bruce Tonkin. Then I will close the call at this point. And again,
I'm sorry. I was on mute. Obviously, I was just going to echo what you've said, Bruce. I think you've said it all. This has engaged all of us in a very thoughtful process. And again, I compliment the entire group. And this is the most important stuff that we have to worry about. And you've done everybody a good service. I think we're done.
Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you all. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.